Hello, you're listening to Microbe Talk, the podcast from the Microbiology Society. I'm Anand Jagatia, and this month we're venturing into uncharted territory and looking at microbes that live in the unforgiving conditions of Antarctica. Captain Robert Falcon Scott led a team of men on the Discovery Expedition in 1901 to explore the mysteries of this largely unknown and untouched continent. The expedition is famous for its scientific legacy, including the discovery of snow-free valleys, emperor penguin colonies, and the location of the South Magnetic Pole. But the team also brought back some mysterious life forms living at the bottom of a lake. It took nearly 60 years for scientists to work out what they really were, cyanobacteria. Dr. Anna Jungblut is a microbiologist studying cyanobacteria today at the Natural History Museum. I went down to the museum to learn more about these microbes and see the very samples that Scott's team brought back over 100 years ago. So Anna, are you quite protective over your samples? Are they like your babies?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, getting more and more.
There's a fridge here which is full of them.
So that's one of our incubators. It's at 4 degrees, so so for them they're able to grow there. They grow quite slowly, so we have them here. Here we see them. There are different types of cyanobacteria which slightly vary in color, so we have some really blue-green one and even some more purple one.
Oh yeah, there's some orange ones.
Yeah,
so are these all yours then? These
yeah
all
they're
samples?
All mine. And so again, so this one is a really interesting one. So this is purple, and that's because it produces phycobili proteins, like special pigments that allow it to grow under very low light.
Tell me a bit more about what cyanobacteria actually are.
So cyanobacteria are photosynthetic bacteria, and most people will probably heard about them under the name blue-green algae. So if you would take grass green and blue and mix them together, you get roughly the color of cyanobacteria. And so that's where the name blue-green algae came from. And people probably come across them because in temperate environments, they are responsible for doing algae blooms and production of toxins and creating harmful algae bloom in parks and in water reservoirs. So for example, if people go to Hampstead Heath and they might see a sign, don't go swimming here because we have a harmful algae bloom, and that's because of cyanobacteria. And so the same group of organisms we find also in Antarctica, but there we have different species which are not typical toxin producers.
Anna works in the life sciences department at the museum, where she's especially interested in microbial diversity in the polar regions, and in particular, cyanobacteria. Can you tell us where we are right now? And so we've kind of come backstage, I guess, where not many people who come to the museum get to see where we are. So could you explain?
Yes, so we are now part of the botany collections, and we are in the cryptogamic collection, which houses all the specimen the museum has from mosses, lichens, ferns, seaweeds and algae, and also cyanobacteria. Traditionally, a lot of the historic expeditions that happened, they came back here to the museum. And so now we're going to try to find the cupboard which houses some of the samples that were collected as part of Captain Scott's discovery expedition. So I think we...
Down here?
So there are some of the collections. So we keep them here in these cardboard boxes to make sure that they're not getting damaged. So let's get them out and go somewhere where we have a little bit more space.
Yes.
So what you see here is a cyanobacteria-dominated microbial mat. And you see they're still green, so that's from the cyanobacteria. And they are like flat sheets that form at the bottom of the lake. So they're really extreme environments, these ponds in Antarctica. So you can't get any organism, like no insects and animals in there. And so it's all microbial dominated. And then, you get these cyanobacteria dominated mats, and they're green because they do photosynthesis. And they can get quite thick and form quite complex ecosystems.
And there's a little handwritten note in here in very neat curator's handwriting.
Yeah, so this is probably not the original writing, but it's quite old. And at that time, so they weren't not quite sure what it is. So at that point, they still thought that the cyanobacteria, which are real bacteria. They thought they are algae, like green algae. And so here they wrote, portion of enormous fresh water, actually fungus penetrating the ice, and they found it when the pond had been thawing. And it says, west of mainland shore, collected on the 2nd of December, 1902.
Wow, so it's collected, yeah. This is over. So this is a stupid question, but this mat isn't alive anymore, is it? Or is it?
No, they're all dried. Okay. And we actually tried to see if we could grow them again, because there are records that cyanobacteria have been stored dried in cupboards of researchers for 40 years. And we tried it, but we couldn't grow them. So we think they're really dead.
Okay. So how would these structures then have formed? So you said that in the pond where these were collected, there would be hardly any other life forms or no other life forms. It's just microbes.
Yeah, that's correct. So these are really extreme environments. They are permanently temperature. They are dark for several months in winter. They have 24-hour daylight in the summer. They can have really high salt concentration. And so it's extreme for any more complex life. And so the cyanobacteria are one of the first organisms that would colonize these environment, because they are photosynthetic, so they only need some nutrients and the light from the sun to create sugars and live. And once they're there, they form these matrix structures, because they're filamentous, and so they're like these hair structures. And once they're formed a matrix structure, then different other organisms will colonize it, and you will also get protists like unicellular eukaryotes, like amoeba and ciliates, living inside this matrix structure.
So the mats themselves that form kind of then provide like a habitat for other organisms to then come in and colonize.
Yeah, that's what we think, that other microbial organisms like protists will colonize and live in there. And potentially it's an advantage to live in a microbial mat in these extreme environments, because organisms be in closer proximity, and it might be easier for recycling and sharing of nutrients.
Wow, so they kind of create this whole ecosystem then in these quite extreme environments.
Yeah, that's true. So these microbial mats are a distinct environment from the life in the water. And also when we measure it, the nutrient condition inside of the microbial mats are a lot higher than in the water. So they're really, even though they're covered by water, they're a different environment.
So, and what kind of different microbial mats do we see in different environments? So do they all look like these green ones, or do we see different shapes, different colors?
Yeah, so they can look quite different, and there are two really distinct types of microbial mats. So the ones we see here, they were collected from a shallow meltwater pond, and so there might have been a few millimeter to a few centimeters thick, and they're probably flat. And if you would have taken out a sample with a spatula, it looks a bit like a lasagna. And so there would probably, a lot of them are orange on the top, because they produce UV screens, and then they go green to do photosynthesis. And then eventually they might go purple for other bacteria below that do photosynthesis, and then they go anoxic, so they're a smell of rotten eggs. And so they're structured by different physical and chemical gradients. And then the other type of microbial mat that we find in ice-covered lakes. And so they have layers, but the layers are annual layers, like tree rings. So every summer they will grow, and they form a layer of filaments. And then in winter they stop growing, because it's dark. And then you have sediment fall on top, and you get a sediment layer. And then in summer, next summer, they will grow through it again. And so they are like tree rings. And these mats have this tree ring structure that can either be flat or form three-dimensional microbial-like structure. So they look a bit like fairy castles. So they have little pinnacles and little web structures. And yeah, they're quite complex structures.
Why are they important kind of life forms to study, and what some of the aims and questions in your research?
So these microbial mats are really important, because you find them everywhere in Antarctica. So they're the first organisms that colonize this environment, and they are the primary producer. So then other organisms that we call secondary producers, who then rely on the productions of the sugars, will rely on the cyanobacteria. And so they're the most important organism creating biological material in these freshwater ecosystems in Antarctica.
Right, so they're kind of like the base of the pyramid, really, and then they're supporting all of the other life systems which then spring up
Yeah, so that's, yeah, that's correct. So that's why we also call them keystone taxa, because they're at the basis of the food web, and they're also not only the basis of the food web for the nutrients and carbon, but also because they create environments that makes that allow the survival for other organisms. And we are interested to understand what is the diversity, like how many species there are, and or kind of taxa, and then to look how they change with environmental conditions, and then relate these environmental conditions to potential future climatic-driven environmental change.
And so as part of your research as well, you've managed to go to Antarctica and sort of study these things in the wild. And there's a picture of you over here with some penguins in the background. Is that you?
Yeah, so this there we were really fortunate. So this was part of a trip where we revisited some of the sites that Shackleton had visited as part of his expedition. So this is at Cape Royds on Ross Island. And this is at a really special site where there is Pony Lake next to the hut where Shackleton was. And Pony Lake, because they kept the ponies on the lake in winter. And that's next to the biggest, the most southern Ardelia penguin colony in the world. And so we had special permission to go there and sample the mats there.
So what kind of things did you do on your field trip to Antarctica? What kind of research were you carrying out?
Yeah, so we have, we do different types of things. So the other year, so last year, I worked with the British Antarctic Survey. So we went to Sydney Island, which is part of the South Orkneys, where I collected microbial mats from the different lakes that are in these environments. And so that means that I was based at the station, and then with the field support, we would go out on daily trips and hike over the glaciers and go past the fur seal colonies and collect samples from these microbial mats. So at Sydney Island, there are roughly 16 lakes that have been studied for a long time. And we sampled all of them. So that took roughly a month to do. But then there are also some other lakes. So working in the McMurdo Ice Shelf, where I've worked with the New Zealand and US program, they are called perennial ice-covered lakes. So they have the whole year round an ice cover, but they melt and the edges. So they're not like a subglacial lake. So they are in contact with the atmosphere. And you have meltwater streams in the summer, and so they have this ice cover which is 3 to 5 meters thick.
Wow. So how do you study things underneath an ice that's that thick?
So yeah, so then I've been really lucky that some of my colleagues are really keen divers. So they have been working at Antarctica doing diving for a very long time. So then we've been going in the field, and then they drill a hole into the ice and melt a hole, and then they do the diving through the ice, and then collect the samples up to 20 meters deep in the lake, or even deeper, yeah. We want to know what's there, like how do they compare? Are they biogeographically distinct environments? Are the lakes all different, or are they the same? So that's one type of the work. And another type of the work is that we study them to find out why they form these structures. So it's not really known why a microbial community would decide to form a three-dimensional structures. There are different ideas why they form it. So one might be that they're different organisms grow in different ways, or they grow towards the light, or there's a nutrient competition. So that's an ecological question we're really interested in. And the last one is that that these structures are very similar to life on early Earth. And so we work together with geobiologists, and we try to find out why they form these three-dimensional structures. And then this knowledge of the living mats can be used to improve the interpretation of fossil microbial structures.
And coming kind of back to your research more generally, before Scott went on his, Antarctic expedition, they referred to Antarctica as terra incognita because they just didn't know anything about it. And it kind of strikes me that the same is maybe true of these microbial mats. Like we're still a lot for us to learn. We're just trying to find out, who they are, where they are, how they grow, why they grow. Is that kind of, do you think of yourself as maybe an explorer in the same way that people like Scott were?
Well, maybe in the kind of this new era of DNA sequencing. Yeah, so Scott went there, and actually Scott went to the McMurdo Dry Valleys, where we find these fairy castle-shaped microbial mats in the lake. And because they couldn't see what's in the lake, they thought the dry valleys was the most deadest place on earth. There was like no life at all. But they thought this because they didn't really have the right tools to see the life. And so now we're able to find this life, and we can apply DNA sequencing, which allows us to really describe them. So people have been describing them by morphology, but it's been really hard. So people have their very good records of what species are there, but it has its limitations because they're quite small. They look very similar. They can change their morphology. And a lot of them we can't culture. And so it's really hard to understand the true richness of these communities. And so now we're in the DNA sequencing era where we can really, push the frontier of knowing what's in these mats.
And so what's next for you then, and what kind of research questions are you working on now, and have you got any trips coming up?
Yeah, so we are still very much describing these microbial mats. So there's still lakes in the dry valleys where they have never been sequenced thoroughly, or we studied the microbial structures. We're still in the process of finding out what's there and how the diversity changes with environmental gradients. But we're now also interested to find out how they might respond to environmental change driven by climatic change. So are they going to be resilient? Are they going to change? And so that's going to be the next question, using comparisons of old and modern samples to see how have they changed over long time scales, how are they changing on spatial change, spatial scales, to find out what's going to happen in the future, and how is that going to affect the biology in polar regions.
And I think, a lot of people will be familiar with this idea of rainforests and trees as being other forms of primary producers that are really important for supporting biodiversity and for our climate. But they might not be as familiar with organisms like microbial mats and cyanobacteria, which basically have the same function, but in different areas of the earth. So this is really important research.
Yeah, so we think it's really important research that we know what's happening and what type of cyanobacteria are there, and what other organisms are in there. So now we're moving on to looking at all of the bacteria, and we still know a lot less from the protists that are in there. So that's the next step, to understand what fungi, what amoeba, what ciliates are in there. And so there's still a lot to discover.
That's it for this week. You can find out more about us on our website, microbiologysociety.org, and check out our blog, The Microbe Post, for more cool stories from the world of microbiology. We've got a post on there right now about microbes on the International Space Station, which is out of this world. Next month, we'll be back with some highlights from our annual conference in Edinburgh, and hopefully we'll see some of you there. Bye!